Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it's bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Morning, Mark.
Good morning.
866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, stories, and we will talk about other critters, as you will hear in a moment. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. It's cold stun season for the sea turtles, Mark, and your crew's been a little bit busy for last week, for sure, right?
Yes. Yeah, last week was crazy. I know there's been a lot of press about the New England Aquarium end of things, and we can't forget the National Marine Life Center in Bourne. That's where the turtles that we rescue go to be rehabbed, and then some of them flown elsewhere, depending on their condition. A lot of them get flown to other parts of the country after being evaluated and treated initially at the aquarium or the Marine Life Center. There's the volunteer pilots, an organization called Turtles Fly Too, that do great work shipping turtles around, sea turtles around the country to be either further rehabbed or in some cases released. But that all starts with Mass Audubon Wellfleet Bay staff. And our director emeritus, Bob Prescott, started this program years ago. He started noticing a few turtles, sea turtles in the 70s, washing up. And people were like, what? You know, these are subtropical animals from the Gulf of Mexico that are on beaches in Cape Cod in November and December. And it's such a strange thing that it happens at all.
Yeah.
You have the world's most endangered sea turtle, Kemp's Ridley, from the Gulf of Mexico, alive on a 28 degree day, early December on a beach on Cape Cod. But those of us at Mass Audubon and Wellfleet Bay, we're the federally designated first responders, federally permitted first responders for these turtles. We have close to 200 volunteers in any given season that we have trained up and gotten on the permit and communicate with daily. And they do incredible things for it. Ridiculous things, mm-hmm. really. They,
yeah.
Like walking Great Island in Wellfleet at 2 a.m.
And it's
a
cold.
6 mile.
Yeah.
That's not a one-way trip. You're walking back into the wind with whatever turtles you found. And just, it's incredible the response we get from our volunteers and what they do. And then my staff are exhausted. It's 24/7. There's a 24/7 hotline. They're doing all night shifts. They're in the cold or they're in our 55 degree holding room where the turtles get evaluated, processed, tracked from the time they get called in by a volunteer or found by staff. They get tracked, inventoried, and then they get shipped up to either the aquarium or the National Marine Life Center. And last week was just crazy. We had one day with 141 turtles.
Wow.
I think that was our third biggest single day total ever. And you can't really predict it. You know, you don't know going into it. Is it going to be a 5 turtle day or 150 turtle day?
Right.
And so, you know, we're just straight out, or my staff are. I don't do much.
Yeah.
I sort of hover around and make suggestions and annoy them, but they're doing great work.
Yeah, and we should mention this because, you know, sometimes people along the beach and they see it, they think it's dead, right? They go, oh, there's a dead turtle, but maybe not. They can appear dead and still be very much alive, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's an important point. And the biggest thing is on these bayside beaches and increasingly random beaches, like there was one in Falmouth Beach
really?
Last week.
Wow.
And the person didn't know they tried to put it back in the water. And that's not what you do. So if you happen to find a sea turtle, and you're most likely will find them on a bayside beach between Sandwich and Provincetown, but mostly from like Dennis to North Truro, you put it above the high tide line so the water doesn't get it again, cover it in seaweed to cut the wind, just get it out of the elements, and then mark it in some way. And then you call us at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary. And there's an option 2 that goes right to the sea turtle staff 24/7. And they can go pick it up and we get it temperature stabilized and then start processing it and work on the logistics of getting it up to the aquarium. We have volunteers who drive the turtles up to the turtle hospital in Quincy.
Do you need more?
As well.
Do you need more volunteers, or do you have enough?
Well, we're always looking for the right volunteer. Mm-hmm. We're not looking for tons of new volunteers because we have so many names on a list. But if you like long walks on the beach,
in the cold
at 2 a.m, right? So you know, the ideal person is someone like someone called back before the season, and I happened to be near the front desk, and I was like, "Oh, let me talk to this person." And they were like, "Well, I just retired to the, you know, Wellfleet, and I would love to walk Great Island at night, and you know, I'm here all winter." And it's like, "Bing, bing, bing, right? Check, check, check. That's the kind of person we're looking for." And then so, anybody interested now that is really wants to be dedicated to it and do the training and get on the permit and can walk at night and things like that, especially if you have a walking partner, then we could probably use you. But right now it's, you know, it's mid-season. We're not looking for new volunteers for this season. But just it's important that the public knows, even if you're not on our permit, that you know what to do
What to do if you find
when you
one,
see a turtle that could make the difference for that turtle. Because as it gets later in the season, the smaller Kemp's Ridleys are less likely to be alive.
yeah.
And so getting them stabilized quickly is critical. We're getting into loggerhead season, so we're getting away from the dinner plate size Kemps, although they'll keep coming in. And now we're getting like 50, 80-pound loggerhead
Wow.
turtles, sometimes even more. They're bigger, so they can survive longer into the season before cold stunning.
So, are you still doing this into January then?
Yes, and that didn't used to be the case. You know, it's a shifting, sort of a shifting baseline over the years. I mean, it used to be that 80 turtles was a season total. Now 800 turtles is
Wow,
a season total.
800.
We're at 700 now, and there's really no end in sight. And we do get live turtles into the first week of January every year now, a loggerhead or two that are still alive in early January. That never used to be the case.
No.
There are more turtles overall being drawn up as, you know, the Gulf of Maine has been getting warmer and warmer, plus the conservation efforts on the nesting beaches, putting more turtles out into the water. So it's sort of a two-step process that has resulted in more turtles cold stunning, and we've had to ramp up our efforts accordingly,
Yeah, the
just
save them, yeah.
exponentially over the years. I've got eight staff just doing that for 2 to 3 months.
Wow. All right, moving on to birds. We had the waterfowl census that happened over this past weekend.
Yes, the annual Cape Cod Bird Club waterfowl census. Census is a strong word, but certainly a very a good subsampling of the freshwater bodies on the Cape. And volunteers will take an entire town's worth or part of a town's worth. Like, you can't do all of Barnstable, it's gigantic. So that gets carved up, and different people take different sections. And so, on one of the 2 days of the weekend, you just go out and you count all the waterfowl on that pond, those ponds. And so, I do East Ham. And East Ham is pretty productive. Herring Pond, in particular, had tons of ducks on it, you know, ruddy ducks and widgeon and over 100 ringneck ducks and, you know, swans, and it's been going on for decades, and so it's a nice little trend where you can look at what's happening with ducks. And ducks are among the birds in North America that are doing pretty well. There's been a lot of focused conservation aimed at waterfowl, aimed at, no pun intended, but it's aimed at is a key term, because a lot of the conservation has been done by Ducks Unlimited, which is a duck hunting organization. And so because of that, there's been a lot of wetland protection all through the Prairie Pothole region, all through the middle north part of the continent, which is sort of the duck factory. And so as a result, ducks are doing surprisingly well. And, you know, we see things like there isn't a lot of ice anymore. That first weekend in December, it used to often be ice. The people on Saturday were complaining about ice, in part because we don't see it so much anymore. So you see a pond iced over, it's like, what the heck? That's not supposed to happen
Yeah.
anymore. But by later in the day, a lot of the ice was gone. And I did mine on Sunday, and there really was no ice, even on little ponds. There may be a little bit of skim ice on one pond first thing, but that's changed. You know, and I think that the waterfowl keep coming because it's later in the season that they see ice over up north, which will then push them down here. And so we'll have them, you know, more waterfowl will keep coming into the winter. But it's just an excuse to get out,
Yeah,
Mindy.
no, it's
Another,
a why
gotta do
not,
it.
right? Yeah, you got to do it.
Sorry, gotta
And then
go. Gotta do the waterfowl census.
and of course, following the waterfowl census, we have the Christmas bird counts coming up, which as we talk about every year. And those start with this is the first one this weekend?
Yes. Yeah. So the traditional first weekend of the count, which always happens in mid-December, you have the Buzzard's Bay count, which includes Falmouth and also the other side of Buzzard's Bay, the sort of off Capes side of Buzzard's Bay, Wareham, and other parts of Buzzard's Bay there. So that's traditionally on the Saturday. And then Sunday is the Cape Cod count, as it is misleadingly known, because it's very old. It goes back 90 years. It used to be the only Christmas bird count. And so they just called it the Cape Cod Christmas Birds Count. Well, now there's like four others, but that one goes from like Harwich and Brewster up to Eastham. It sort of, includes Chatham, so that's an important, very old count. And then I oversee the Truro count, which I'm probably going to have on the 31st. Sent out a poll to my birders. Apparently, not a lot of partiers, so they were happy to get up at 4 in the morning on New Year's Eve day. And then then the island counts. They've been this, I don't know what the dates are, but it's a Sunday, probably the 29th. And they've been on the same day in recent years, which sort of bifurcates the good birders, but they managed to get those done. And so those are just a lot of fun, and you never know what you're going to see out there. And
And
increasingly, there are just things that are staying later and trying to overwinter here as the winters get warmer. And it's just fun to find those
that's
things. And
part
it's
of
just a
the,
big
I'd
scavenger
say it's
hunt.
part of the fun of it is that you never know what you're going to see. And for folks who aren't familiar with it, you have a designated area, but tell us about the purpose. Why do we do these Christmas bird counts?
Right. And so they started 125 years ago by National Audubon. A guy Chandler Robbins, and it was an alternative. No, Frank Chapman. It was an alternative to an old tradition of hunting on Christmas Day, going out and they called them side hunts. It was competitive hunting. You just go out on Christmas Day, see how many things you can shoot. And so this was like, hey, why don't we see how many birds we can count? And it's just grown so much since then, and there are counts all over the continent. And it's a 15-mile wide circle that gets there's one person in charge of fielding the teams and compiling all the data and then entering it on the website. And then so you have sector leaders, there's the compiler, and then you have sector leaders who are in charge of some part of the circle, and they kind of get their own teams. And like for the Cape Cod count, there's like an Eastham Bayside and an Eastham Oceanside, and someone does North Chatham and et cetera, et cetera. And everybody comes together in some way, sometimes virtually in recent years, but the best way is still to come together over food at the end of the day, and everybody shares their war stories and keep some rare thing they found in their back pocket for a big reveal at the end. Gasp. I had a lazuli bunting, what some crazy thing that and everyone's like, woo, but the compilations are really fun, and they're actually important for things like, oh, I counted that pond. You counted that pond? I thought I was supposed to count that pond. And then so the compiler knows and deals with that accordingly in the data. So yeah, it's a lot of fun to have that social aspect of it at the
Yeah,
end of
for
the
sure.
day.
All right, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Kathy in Harwich wonders what phone number to call if you find a turtle on the beach.
The 508-349-2615. So every beach that's likely to have a sea turtle washing up on it, meaning bayside beaches, like I said, from Sandwich to Provincetown, one of the first things the staff does in the beginning of the season in the preparatory period is to go out and put up a sign at every little path through the dunes out to some beach with exactly what to do if you find a sea turtle, the number to call. Right. They're little. I think we need to increase our sign budget because
Yeah.
you know how it is with signs. You
Right.
just there's so many, and
And you just
people
don't
don't
pay
look at them.
attention. Yeah.
I
Yeah.
keep running into dog walkers and people. I'll be like, "Oh, have you seen any sea turtles?" And I walk here every day for years. What sea turtle? Like they
Yeah.
walk right by the sign and don't see it. But it's the number for Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, right? We're, you know,
Yep.
we're the ones taking in the turtles. So if you didn't get that, you can Google that up.
Right. All right.
And there's a option two for sea turtles that'll go right through to the sea turtle staff.
All right. Tell us about this northern lapwing on Nantucket. I know it was in the bird report, but somebody might have missed that. So this is kind of exciting, right?
Yes. Yeah, really exciting. And sort of expected because one turned up in like the Canadian Maritimes, but the northern lapwing is a really interesting plover relative. It's very different than any plover we have around here. It's big. If you've been to Europe, you may have seen them, whether you knew it or not. Because like in the fall in Europe, they get into these big flocks and all the in the farm fields. They like agricultural areas. They're sort of like a killdeer around here, which is a biggish plover that likes, you know, fields, not so much beaches. And so it's that kind of a plover, big but with like really broad, rounded wings. Lapwings in general are more common in places like Africa, particularly Africa, but also South America. But this one species of lapwing is in the Northern Hemisphere, and it's a European bird. And so they would typically be migrating from like Scandinavia to mainland Europe or to India. And occasionally one will make it across the pond, as we say, and make it over to the US, but very, very rarely, because that's against the prevailing winds at this time of year. The prevailing winds would be blowing them away from us. But every once in a while, like after Hurricane Sandy, there was this really interesting phenomenon where, or dirt leading up to, and including Hurricane Sandy, there was just their winds just coming across the Atlantic from Europe for days. And we had this fallout of northern lapwings, super, super rare. And they got sprinkled up and down the East Coast, but particularly Massachusetts, especially Nantucket, where there were two and then later three. And so, in the same basic place, Bartlett's Farm Fields, birder named Louis Dentiste, which is French for Louis Dentist, found this bird. He was shocked. He had that experience that, you know, us dedicated birders have when you find something really rare, where you're just like, you know, you're like the
What is
pulse
it?
goes
Yeah.
up and you're sort of like shaking and you're like fumbling with your camera, like, please don't fly away, please don't fly away. And he got some kind of sketchy photo of it flying away, but it's stuck in, and other birders saw it. And actually, I haven't checked. I don't know if it's still there, but when they showed up, 20 whatever year that was, 2012 Hurricane Sandy, was it 12, 2013? It's they stayed all winter, and so you know, they it might be there for a while, but and it's just such a crazy looking bird. You think of a plover around here, people think of piping plovers or a semi-pommated plover, but this thing has this long wispy crest, and it's like shimmering green and purple on the back if you get a good look at it. It's just out of this world as far as plovers go. And this is a young one. Often the vagrants are young ones. You could tell it's got little crisp white edges to all of the feathers on the back. But if you got it in good light, if you know, got it near the fence at Bartlett's Farm and got it in the right light, you would see this kind of shimmering. It's kind of like the head of a grackle.
Oh,
That sort
huh.
of that
A
sort of
shimmery thing,
shimmeriness, a
yeah.
subtle green and a little bit of purple on the back, plus the long wispy crest, like. Dr. Seussian is what I think of it as a Seussian creature when I see a northern lapwing.
And we have a picture of it up on our website with your latest bird report, if folks want to take a
Yes.
look. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we also have the spotted towhee still in Provincetown, still hanging out.
Yes, the famous spotted towhee. It's like our usual towhee, but different. And so out west, the species of towhee that they split off from ours back in the 80s, used to be just rufous-sided towhee. That was the only kind in the whole U.S. Then they split the western kind, which looks very different. It's got big white spots all over the back, and it, they don't. And they do hybridize a little bit in the middle, but it's a separate species, and it very rarely comes east. And a birder found one out in this thicket at the Provincetown Airport, which is a pretty well-known birding spot. If you just look at where it is, so any kind of bird that's sort of off course or coming down from Canada, coming across the Gulf of Maine, ends up out over the water, wants to get back to land. Oftentimes, one of the first places they'll end up is Race Point, and the first thicket with like actual shrubs and small trees, and it's kind of swampy there, is at the Provincetown Airport. And so there have been epic fallouts of migrants there. And so birders do check it, and this somebody found this spotted towhee, and it's been hanging in there ever since. It's not easy to see. I've gone twice and still haven't seen it, but I've heard it. Has kind of a distinctive, almost catbird-like that it does periodically. But lucky birders that hang in there, so I think they figured out you can kind of sit in your car in the parking lot and look behind the Enterprise rent-a-car signs, and eventually it'll pop up. But it's just a very cool bird, and it seems to be hanging in there. And it's a rarity that's not at someone's feeder. It's in a pretty natural area, just doing its own
Doing its
thing,
thing, yeah.
which is always nice. But, feeder rarities are like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But this is like a wild bird doing wild things, and who knows, it got here and it's hanging in there.
Yeah. Well, as long as, I guess, as long as it has a food source, right? I mean, why go in?
Yeah,
Yeah,
I
you got
mean,
food.
and
Why
so
do you want to move? Yeah.
and towhees are a good example of why leaf litter is important. And it's in a thicket where there's a dense permanent leaf litter. And permanent leaf litter is what birds need, not like the leaves that fell on your lawn last month. Those don't matter as much, but they scratch around. If you've ever watched a towhee, I think a lot of people on the Cape have seen this. If you have feeders or whatever, you see a towhee and they do that thing where they hop back and forth and they're flipping over leaves, and there's tons of stuff to eat under the leaves. And there's seeds and there's fruit and there's bittersweet and other stuff in that thicket. And so, yeah, it's got food, it's got water, it's sort of swampy there. It's got cover. It's dense, very dense shrubby to get it out of the wind. And so it has what it has
That's
what
what
it
it
needs.
needs, yeah. Dee Dee in Dartmouth says, is there a huge drop off of bird counts from previous years?
Like the numbers of birds
I
found
don't know if
on the
she means I
counts.
don't know if she means the numbers of birds or the numbers of counts. The counts are pretty
Yeah,
reg
I right. I think she means the numbers of birds. Yeah, the numbers of bird counts have gone up.
Yeah.
But the numbers of birds, it depends on the species. And it's funny, at Cape Cod Bird Club last night, we had our annual sort of December holiday thing, and two local high school kids were there to give talks about their scholarship trip up to Hog Island. They did a We send two kids to a birding camp up at Hog Island, Maine
Oh,
National
that's
Audubon Camp
cool. Yeah.
every June. And yeah, we're looking for candidates for this year too, so check the Bird Club website for the application for that. But one of them, Allison McCumber, was her dad's the biologist at the base, who's telling me that for science fair, she had been looking at Christmas bird count trends as a, I don't know, a high school sophomore. Anybody can do this. You can go on the Christmas bird count website and make trends for whatever period of years and whatever geographic area, either a single count or a whole state or whatever. And it really varies. Like mockingbirds, I've been watching that decline. Mockingbirds have declined precipitously over the last 30, 40 years for some reason. And then other things are going up. It depends on the species. Like I said, waterfowl are doing well, hawks are doing well. It seems like more hawks are wintering further north. So depending on where you are, they're either increasing or decreasing because of where they're choosing to spend the winter. There was that 3 billion bird study that got tons of press 4 or 5 years ago, whenever that was, that concluded that from it was a very broad study looking at the whole continent, concluding that there are 3 billion fewer birds than in the 70s, looking at various lines of evidence, including radar, where you can distinguish bird migrating birds in NEXRAD radar, but also Christmas bird counts and breeding bird surveys and that kind of thing. But there are always winners and losers. Some birds are
Right.
doing better,
And
and
some are
some
not.
birds are
Yeah.
not doing so well. Yeah.
Right. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, tell us a little bit about the Winter Finch Report.
Ah, the Winter Finch Report. Yeah, it comes out earlier in the fall, and this is something that birders look forward to, especially here in the northern tier of states, where we never know what we'll see in terms of numbers of this suite of songbirds of the northern forest. Most of them are finches. Things like crossbills, you know, red crossbills, white-winged crossbills, even red-breasted nuthatches, bohemian waxwings, common red poles, just red poles. They just lumped all the red poles into one species to the disappointment of some birders. They're no longer hoary red pole in common. It's just red pole. Siskins, you know, purple finches. These things are pretty erratic from year to year in terms of how many we see, because they're not on a regular migration. Like a warbler on the same date flies to the same patch of forest in Costa Rica for the winter and then comes back on the same date. These finches sort of roam around evaluating the seed crops of different trees across the boreal forests. So they might go from British Columbia to, you know, Nova Scotia, just looking for, you know, pine cones with a lot of crops, particularly spruce cones, hemlocks, depending on the species. You know, the red poles are evaluating birch crops across the subarctic and boreal forests. And if birch crops aren't good, then we'll see them down here. But the outlook this year wasn't great. You know, the species by species winter finch forecast was like, oh, lots of food in the north. They'll mostly stay in the north. But the Cape is sort of an exception in that we always get a few. Just, I think, by nature of the fact that especially the outer Cape just sort of sticks out there into the Gulf of Maine, into the Atlantic. And I think we get some that will come down from like Nova Scotia, even Newfoundland. If winter finches exhaust a food supply there and end up out over the water, they'll end up in P-Town, right? Or Truro. So there have been a few white-winged crossbills. Somebody had a red crossbill in the course of doing the waterfowl census over the weekend. Someone found a bohemian waxwing in Truro. So we should never rule it out. We should always be on the lookout. And even purple finches. I had three purple finches stop by my feeders the other day, and I never see them. As I'm out birding, I'll hear an occasional purple finch fly over. They have a distinctive little pick, pick, pick flight call that they do. But this was nice. They actually stopped in on my platform feeder, and I got good looks at male purple finches, and I don't get that very often. So you never know here on the Cape. We'll always get a few. And so you might get some siskins. You might see one of the other species of winter finch at any time. And always be on the lookout for a bohemian waxwing, which would be a bigger bird in a flock of cedar waxwings. Mm-hmm. Or they'd just be by themselves or with robins. Like someone just found one sitting in a tree near some feeders up in Truro the other day. So always have them as possibilities in the back of your mind. But I don't think we're going to get flooded with winter finches as sometimes happens.
And you were mentioning the purple finches that you saw. A lot of people mistake the purple finches with the regular little finches that we get.
House finch.
Yeah.
The house finch is the common, very, very, very common red-headed, you know, the males have the red heads and they're streaky. Those are the ones that are at your feeders, nesting in your yard.
Nesting purple on your
finches,
porch. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. They nest on porches. They're called house finch for a reason. And they were actually brought here as cage birds. They're not native to the eastern U.S., but, they basically are. They're not going anywhere. They all originated from released cage birds when they made it illegal to keep them anymore. But that's a bird of, they called them Hollywood finches back in the day when they were cage birds. Go to the pet store and get a Hollywood finch.
Oh, never heard that.
But those were house finches. It's been, 100 years since anybody had a house finches in cages, I think. But they were from the Southwest. I remember working in the Southwest and seeing house finches nesting in cactuses there. But they now nest everywhere in the whole continent. Yeah. They've basically, the eastern released population just grew and grew and grew and spread and met with the western population, and they're just everywhere now. But an actual purple finch is a rare sight, and they look different. They've got a bigger, blockier head, a different color, like more of a dipped in wine, more of a purplier color. They're not streaky. There's more color on them. There are a lot of differences, but people just get confused and they see a house finch and say, call it a purple finch, because I don't know. Maybe they're old enough to remember when there weren't that many house finches. Probably not that many people that old anymore. But yeah, purple finch is an uncommon sight, but always watch for them at your feeder. And the females are distinctive too. They're very different than a female house finch because they have these broad, pale, they have this striking face pattern, even though they're just sort of brown and streaky. They have this broad, pale line above the eye and another one kind of in the mustache area that gives them this masked look. So very, very different from a house finch. Kind of easy to tell apart once you know the
Once you know the
difference.
difference,
Keep
yeah.
an eye out for them.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday this morning. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Maybe we should start calling it Nature News instead of Bird News because we talk about everything. I wanted to ask
Yes.
you about that raccoon that they found, the dead raccoon they found in East Ham with the porcupine quills. It did end up being rabid. It had rabies. I don't know if you, but
what a bizarre story.
What a bizarre story, because we don't have any porcupines. So do you think somebody picked this thing up on the other side and brought it over the bridge, or what do we think happened?
Yeah, I would love to know the story here. How did it get there?
How
And
did
it
it
had
get
some
here?
kind of a, it had some kind of a cloth on it. Like it had been dumped. And yeah, we don't have porcupines, but here's the weird thing. I don't know, t 12 years ago or something like that, there was a road-killed porcupine in East Ham. And I ended up with some of the quills from that. I have an envelope. It was such a strange thing. I think they just chucked it, but somebody at least saved some of the quills. And that, that's anyone's guess. I think our director at Wellfleet Bay, Melissa Lowe, she had a good theory that maybe it came in on a Christmas tree truck or something like that.
Oh,
Right. Because,
yeah.
wood. Porcupines are sort of north wood. They're common in the north woods. They irritate cabin owners in Maine. They chew on things, and they're pretty common in the north woods. Not so much. There's no like feeder population. They're not in southeastern Mass either,
Right.
right? Some of these other things that have come back, they establish themselves in southeastern Mass first, like fishers. But, Skip Lazelle was a biologist in the 70s who wrote about a lot of the creatures here, and he said something about the famous porcupines of Nickerson State Park. I don't know what that means. There's no porcupines in Nickerson State Park anymore, certainly. I think there was a record on the base, but yeah, I don't know what happened with that. I don't think that's a Cape raccoon.
Yeah, it
I don't
probably
think
came
it.
from somewhere else. Yeah.
Yeah, what a weird
That is
story.
a weird story. All right. So, hey, two different hummingbirds showing up in yards last week.
Yeah, tis the season, oddly enough, for hummingbirds that are not ruby-throated hummingbirds. And neither of these has really been documented in any way yet. It's just somebody in West Barnstable saw one sort of hanging around where she would normally have hanging planters and feeders. So she was sort of wondering, well, maybe it was one of the ruby throats coming back, but n not likely. The ruby throats leave in mid-September. They're pretty much gone by the first week in October. And it doesn't matter if you keep your feeders out, they leave. And the ones we get now are wayward hummingbirds from out west, typically the Pacific Northwest. And it's usually rufous hummingbirds, which is a really cool, really hardy species that nests up into southeast Alaska and then winters in Mexico. But every year, one, two, three go the wrong way and will end up on the Cape, sometimes other parts of the Northeast. And I don't know if these two were rufous hummingbirds, but the point is, if you have a feeder out and it's gotten to the point where they freeze, it's been cold for a couple of weeks, we're getting back into a period where it's not going to be so freezing. So maybe put a hang feeder back out, and you could end up with one of these hummingbirds. They make a hummingbird that a feeder that is heated, and that's what these people who hosted two rufous hummingbirds all winter last year in Orleans, in East Orleans. This older couple had two rufous hummingbirds that wintered all the way through to April at
That's
least.
crazy, huh?
Yeah, and they would go. I saw them like hanging out in a thicket over on Town Cove and Orleans, just nowhere near the feeder. They were probably, fly catching. Warm days in winter, you'll see these gnats. And there are other insects that they can find that we wouldn't know how to find. They're amazingly resilient. If you have a source of nectar that will get them through the days, they can find other things they need and actually gain weight even in the winter because they're very tough. They go into a torpor at night. So they lower their metabolism so they can survive cold nights. Just way tougher than you would ever think. It's just such a, another strange thing. It's like, tropical sea turtles washing up on our beaches and hummingbirds that should be in Western Mexico right now hanging out at feeders. And the other one was in Provincetown, if I didn't say that.
Yeah,
And we're
Barnesville.
hoping to confirm what species they are.
That'd be great.
But yeah.
All right, getting colder, people start thinking about snowy owls. And I mean, it's been a long time since we had that like invasion. What is that? That's not what they
Yeah.
call it. Is that what they call it? Invasion? What do they call it when you get a whole bunch of them?
Usually it's an eruption is the
Eruption. That's
word.
it. Yeah. Yeah.
Eruption with an I.
Yeah.
They're not erupting like out of a volcano.
Not likely to
But
have that this year, but we might see a few.
no, it doesn't seem like it's going to be a huge year, but it's all relative. In the previous 2 winters, there were basically zero, which is unusual. I feel like even in the down years, there's one at the tip of Nauset Beach. The premium habitats for a snowy owl are the tips of the big barrier beaches because they hunt ducks. Most of them are here to hunt ducks. And so that's a premium territory for a snowy owl that's down for the winter. They'll sit at the t they'll sit in the dunes, and then as it gets towards dusk, they get active, and then they'll go out over the water and just pick ducks off and eat them. And they eat lots of other things too. Snowy owls can also get into trouble eating rats with rodenticide in them. So yet another reason not to use the anticoagulant rodenticides and not have your pest control person use them because they could get into snowy owls too, along with all the other owls and hawks around here. But mainly they're eating ducks, and so I've heard of at least three on the Cape. Birders are keeping them kind of secret anymore because of slack-jawed gawkers just kind of walking through the dunes trying to get close, taking cell phone pictures and that sort of thing, and then other photographers also trying to get too close. For the most part, owls are pretty chill. They barely notice you or acknowledge you. But when you've got too many people like going into the dunes and things, it just gets to be a lot. But just be on the lookout and keep a respectful distance. Don't flush it. I mean, if it flew because of you, then you did it wrong. Just kind of stay at a distance where it's still doing its thing and looking around. But it's always special to see. And I'm glad there's some non-zero number of snowy owls this year.
Yeah, they're beautiful, but I'm also thinking when you see, I remember one year there was a little tiny saw-whet owl that you could see up in this tree during the day, and you want to be really careful because if you were to flush that, that little guy might end up dead because of the other birds that would attack it in the daytime, right?
Right. That's the other thing is, they're trying to hide. They might get mobbed, and other predatory birds don't like them. Peregrine falcons will dive on them, and if they're trying to be incognito, and if they're not moving, they could be really difficult to see. And then you force them to fly, then the crows notice them, and other things notice them, or they'll fly across a road and get hit by a car. They definitely get into trouble at airports. And so Norm Smith, retired, semi-retired Mass Audubon biologist of, 50-ish years, is still working with the snowy owls at Logan Airport to relocate them and make sure they don't run into the planes for multiple reasons, including safety of the people in the planes. And so, yeah, there have been some at Logan Airport and weird places. Like I saw one in eBird that was sitting on a parking garage in Watertown. That was a couple of weeks ago. So they will end up in strange places sometimes, in addition to the typical, like the tip of a big barrier beach, like Nauset Beach or something like that. And just quickly, I didn't say why, what drives it. It's lemming populations in the high Arctic where they're nesting. The lemmings are on cycles. Every 4 years, there's often a good amount of lemmings, which means the snowy owls fledge way more chicks, which means we're likely to see more down here. And it's this kind of Arctic Quebec population that tends to drive how many snowy owls we see. So there must have been enough lemmings, at least for enough chicks, that we're getting a few anyway, but not a huge bumper crop.
Right. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you have a bird comment, question, story, you want to talk about other critters, we'd be happy to do that. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. One of the interesting things about this time of year, now that the leaves are all gone off the trees, I get to see where the nests, bird nests are that I didn't see when we had one nest in one of my azalea bushes with a catbird. I was pulling up some weeds and I saw the nest and so backed off and let the birds do their thing. But now I'm seeing I had a nest in my maple tree. I had another nest in my dogwood tree. And I was like, oh, happy. I was sort of sad this year going, oh, I don't have all the nests I usually have. But I did. I just didn't know they were there.
Yes. It's funny you should say that because I noticed a couple on my morning walk. One just like right next to my yard. It was in a little, some multiflora rose that I haven't managed to remove yet. I think it was a cardinal nest, but I'm not sure. Sometimes multiple birds use a nest, which I didn't think happened, but there was a nest in one of the rhododendrons one year that at first it was a cardinal nest and then catbirds repurposed it after the cardinal nest failed, which is kind of interesting.
So
but yeah,
leave,
I noticed
so
another
leave your
one.
Nest then, because they might be reused again.
Yeah. Yeah. And plus it's technically illegal to remove them under the, you know, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. There's some things that you wouldn't think we would need to worry about that are technically illegal, like taking a feather home. Somebody I know found a bald eagle feather in my yard, they show it to me. I'm like, good God, it's a bald. It's like, you know, it's huge. And I had seen a bald eagle that day, but not flying over my yard, but just like the neighbor's yard. But you certainly can't keep a bald eagle feather. Nests do get repurposed in various ways. Typically what you'll see is that a bird will take material from a last year's nest and then move it into the new nest they're making. Because overwhelmingly, songbirds will make a new nest. Even, you know, multiple times over the course of a season, especially if they fledged young, the old nest is disgusting. They need to like if they could, they would set fire to it and take the insurance money and then go build somewhere else because they are gross from being packed with chicks. There's parasites in them. So that's why they make new nests. But when it's sat through the winter, they will. You'll see them visiting an old nest the next year and moving the material to somewhere else. But yeah, and then goldfinch nests are really easy to see because they tend to nest at about the height of a person a lot of times, or a little bit higher. They nest kind of low, and they nest at edges, roadside trees, backyards, in like saplings. And so it's really easy to see goldfinch nests, really easy to see oriole nests, because they're so distinctive, and they'll often hang theirs over a road or at edges. And so, yeah, this is that time of year where we're like, oh, orioles did nest in, you know, pretty close to my yard.
And you might notice an oriole nest, but how do you know the other nest? Is it because of the size? You say, I thought that was a cardinal nest or it was a robin nest. How do you know if you haven't seen the bird there?
Right. Just from experience, you can make an educated guess. Like, goldfinches are incredibly common, and the most likely little cup nest that's about 6, 8, 10 feet off the ground next to a road. That's a goldfinch nest, right? It's not a warbler. It's not some other small bird that are less common. Even yellow warbler, as common as they are, they're not going to be right next to a road so much. And then, you know, the bulky nests that are right around a house are catbirds and cardinals. A robin nest would have mud. They're distinctive. Phoebe nest would be on a ledge under your eaves or something like that. And so they all kind of have their MO. And you can make an educated guess for these really common things that nest around houses.
Yeah. We got an email from Denise who says, in October, you discussed a hawk monitoring a fox. Last year, we observed a hawk tracking a fox through the beach forest trail. He began when the fox worked a log and the hawk sat above, waiting and watching. Eventually, the fox walked away right past us, one of those race point foxes used to humans. As the fox walked up the hill on the trail, the hawk followed along above him. This played out for over 10 minutes. We still wonder what would happen if the fox had scored.
Geez, sounds like a book I would read my children. No, <right? clears throat> The Fox and the Hawks. Yeah, that's interesting. I think I followed that. The fox was following the hawk around.
No, I think it was the other way around.
Hawk was following the fox around.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. Yeah.
Either way, they were just hoping to benefit. They weren't going to eat each other. They were hoping to benefit from the other's work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe the fox wasn't going to finish his breakfast there, and the hawk could kind of swoop down and help him out.
I had a little mystery. There's been a red-tailed hawk hanging out in these small power lines right behind my house here in recent days. And the other morning, I saw it sitting, and then I saw this white thing. I was like, is that another hawk? And I got closer, and it was the wing from one of my neighbor's chickens.
Oh, wow.
Dismembered, hanging from the tree.
Uh-oh.
And then the red tail went over and grabbed it. And then it took that and some other parts of the chicken and went somewhere. And I had gone back in and get my camera. And I'm like, oh, I don't see it anymore. But I traced the snowfall of chicken feathers back to where the red tail had gone into a pine and was plucking it more. And so there's no way to know if the red tail got the chicken.
Or something else.
The red tail's not going to get a chicken at night, certainly, when it's in the coop. It could have been getting kind of leftovers from some mammalian predator that got one of these chickens. I have two different neighbors with chickens. and one of them has one less chicken.
Yeah.
But it was just sort of interesting, but there's no way, it's circumstantial evidence. You couldn't pin that crime on that red tail. It could have been cleaning up after a mammalian predator, kind of like the one following the fox around, hoping to, you know, benefit from the fox's work. Yeah.
And we talked about, you know, the fact that there are no porcupines here. The other one that we say there's no bobcats, but there might be. Isn't there some sightings we've seen in recent years? So in East Ham?
No, in different places. There was the Falmouth one where somebody got like a phone video of one sitting next to their driveway at night. Then in Wellfleet, on the Chequessic Neck Bridge over the Herring River, there was a road-killed one last year. And interestingly, turned out to be a female.
Right.
Typically, if you get it's male predators like cats in particular that wander huge distances. They get cast out from wherever they came from and just wander and wander and wander. And so road-killed, like a road-killed mountain lion in Connecticut, you know, those kinds of things. It wandered from like Michigan, you know, like somewhere really far away. They tend to be males, but that Wellfleet one was a female, and a lot of people are like, there are more, I see them, I hear them. Somebody I know says they saw one treed in sort of the national park of Wellfleet on the bayside. There's like the Herring River, all the Herring River drainage is there. They said they saw a bobcat treed by coyotes there.
Oh, wow.
And then that female. So it's hard to say if there's a small established population or we're just still in the phase where the occasional wandering individual, but a female is interesting. And so that indicates that there could be at least the potential certainly for breeding and maybe even a small population, but they're on that list of things that have been increasing and moving east with the regeneration and growth of forests.
Right. So we could, and there's certainly a lot more of them around off the Cape. So yeah, could be. All right.
And there was another photo that Mass Wildlife shared with me of one just walking through a suburban backyard in like Osterville or something.
All right. So keep your eyes open and let us know.
Yep.
All right. Mark Verity, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, joins us the second Tuesday of every month. Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome. Catch you next time.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Burdery and William Coulter.